Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
I found out that you can catch giant rainbows and browns in the middle of lakes and on grasshopper patterns.
No, in the middle of the day.
Mm-hmm.
That's weird.
And that's a new thing for me. I've always caught them along shorelines, yeah.
Something just blowing.
I had fish blowing up on big grasshoppers in the middle of Georgetown Lake near Phillipsburg, Montana. Wow. Fish up to 28 inches. And again, it was like sharks eating penguins. They were leaving spray trails of like 3 feet.
Really?
Yeah, it was awesome.
That was my good friend Gene Shropshire sharing a story and a great tip for your next stillwater adventure. This is episode 163 of the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today. We'll help you on your fly fishing journey with classic stories covering steelhead fishing, fly tying, and much more.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the Fly Fishing Show. Head over to wetflyswing.com/Facebook and join our community and ask a question for the next guest. Gene Shropshire, my good friend and one of my biggest mentors, is here to share some tips on dry fly fishing and some stories about my old man. We hear how he became a senior trout bum in recent days here, what the last excursion to Montana was like, and why Southern Oregon is his go-to spot for trophy trout. Before we get started, I wanted to take a moment to thank our sponsors. SoFly Gear, headed up by 17-year-old James Carlin of the U.S. Youth Fly Fishing Team, has a buttery soft, quick-drying apparel line that I've been loving. Head over to wetflyswing.com/SoFly and support James and the podcast today. The Fly Fishing and Tying Journal has an exceptional fall edition that's out right now. Head over to wetflyswing.com/FTJ to support the great work Craig and the gang have created just for you. Again, that's wetflyswing.com/FTJ and also wetflyswing.com/SOFLY. So without further ado, here is Gene Shropshire.
This is Dave from the Wet Fly Swing podcast, and today I'm happy to introduce Gene Shropshire, an old friend, and somebody I've known all my life. There's only been one other person I've interviewed on this podcast that I didn't know, or that I knew more than you, longer than you, is my dad. So yeah, that's what's amazing. So, and we'll probably talk about my dad somewhere along the way. But so Gene, thanks for doing this.
You're welcome. Very good to see you again, Dave. It's been too long.
I know. Yeah. It's been, I'm not sure how long it's been, but this is
a couple of years with your family and those things involved. God. Yeah.
It's been, I know, that's a crazy thing. Time flies. And the cool thing is, man, I mean, I haven't seen you a couple of years, but you're looking good. You're looking like you got the boat. You're working on the boat.
Well, you guys got to have his priorities.
Yeah, exactly. it's pretty cool. I mean, I guess I was kind of picturing, you know, coming over here and being like, oh, Gene, you know, gave up fishing. He's, you know, kind of like, that's not going to happen.
Absolutely not. My wife has been giving me a hard time lately because I christened myself the old timers trout bum.
Yeah,
I essentially have not worked since May of this spring. I've been fishing almost continually. I don't think I've missed a week. Yeah. A week has gone by where I haven't wet a line somewhere. So it's been a great pleasure to finally be at that stage of my life to be able to free up.
So you're retired now.
I am semi-retired. Yeah. I'm still taking jobs as a contractor as I see fit, if you will.
Yeah.
But aside from that, my goals are to pursue the music that I do and fly fishing in particular.
That's right. And we passed by the Gibson guitar in there, which
Yeah, I've got several Gibsons, and amongst other things. And I've been pursuing jazz since I was been in my late 40s, although I've been playing since I was in my early 20s.
Yeah.
That's right. And that's the cool thing is that I don't forget, you just reminded me, but you basically taught me. I mean, I'm now a professional guitar player, but I've got a guitar, and actually my daughter now has a little guitar.
Oh, well, nice.
And really that comes back to you because you taught me some of the basics, and I can do enough that I can play a little bit of
music. I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, sharing the wealth is what it's all about.
Exactly. But I'm nowhere near the guitar player. I mean, you're essentially, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, you're a professional guitar player. I mean, when you look back at your life,
when you think fly fishing, guitar, I mean, which one, I mean, took more work to get to the level, do you think?
Well, for me, fly fishing came really naturally. I knew from a very early age, my first fishing excursion was when I was 5 years old. And somewhere in the family archives, we have films of my first fish, which was caught in a lake in Princeton, on Princeton University's grounds. And it was a little crappie, you know. And right from the very beginning, I knew this was for me.
Yeah.
And so I, while other people were in grade school, perhaps like, you know, studying what Mickey Mantle did or Wilt Chamberlain did, you know, I was reading books that had to do with fly fishing.
No kidding.
And fishing in general, yeah.
So all the way back to five.
All the way back to 5 years old was my first fishing excursion. Yeah. By the age of seven, I insisted on my dad teaching me to fly fish since he was a avid fly fisherman.
He was.
And yes, he was. Yeah. And he taught me a lot, although there was a lot of exasperating times for him up until the time I was about 10 or 12 because I was constantly in a tree or had some kind of a
What was your dad's name?
It was also Gene.
It was. Yeah. You're Gene. Mm-hmm. So you're Gene Jr.
No, he didn't have a middle name. My middle initials are Robert, and he did not have a middle name. So.
Oh, gotcha.
So he wanted to avoid the junior thing. He didn't want everybody calling me junior.
There you go. But there's another Gene Shropshire, and your dad was...
Yeah, there is. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. There was. So anyhow, it came natural to me, getting back to that question about, you know, and guitar I really didn't pursue. I started actually playing guitar when I was nine. But unfortunately, my parents couldn't afford a higher quality guitar, and my brain got tiresome from fighting inexpensive guitars. I only took lessons for about a year, and then I let it go.
Yeah.
I picked it back up again when I was 19.
Uh-huh.
But guitar has been a real struggle for me because I don't really feel like I'm that talented, and it's been a labor of love, no doubt.
Yeah.
But it's been very hard for me, you know, and I stumbled through it.
Yeah.
And being self-taught was, you know, definitely not a good idea. It would have been to my advantage to seek out a good teacher.
Yeah. Did you ever take lessons?
Have a teacher who self-professed not a good teacher, but a very good guitarist.
Gotcha.
And he's the guy that taught me much of the theory that I needed to learn and other things. But the fishing end of it was natural for me. And it always has been. Not only did I have a super great love for it, but it just came really easily to me. Casting was easily, you know, I was a very good caster. I won several fly fishing casting awards, you know, before I was 15 years old.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, so
just local, you know, just local casting contests at their grassroots level.
Sure.
And they were mostly, you know, maybe 15, 20 contestants, but,
yeah.
you know, as that went on.
Huh.
And then I became involved in Trout Unlimited, the Ernie Schweber chapter.
Oh, yeah.
When I was, I'm pretty sure I was 18 or 19 then.
That's right.
I was still in high school,
and
I know.
Where was this? What, you're in New Jersey?
Was in New Jersey, still there.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, but never a week went by in my early life that I wasn't out on the water fishing for bass or trout.
Or, there you go.
Anything I could get my hands on.
So this has been a lifelong
It has been, and I've never, you know, let other things get in the way
yeah.
to it, and totally it, encompass
Totally.
You know, my life away from fly fishing.
Even with,
from fishing generally.
Even when you think about, you know, the girls, booze, all that stuff, you still...
I was chastised on a regular basis, you know, during high school, early, you know, junior high school and high school for, you know, what do you do with all those trout you catch?
Yeah.
You know, well, I put them back in the water, you know, alive, and yep. no one could really understand...
So you were doing that.
...the reasoning behind
that. Catch and release... Before it was.
Yeah. There was a couple of guys that I befriended. Wayne Campbell was one of them through Trout Unlimited. There was another gentleman whose name was Joe Armenti. These guys were really good fly fishermen back then, and they introduced me. They were older than me, and they introduced me to a lot of techniques that I didn't know, you know, in my teenage years.
Wow.
I also worked in several sporting goods stores. Where I met more people too.
Gotcha.
And we, you know, Joe and I, we didn't fish a lot together because of different reasons, all of them positive. But we routinely go to places like the Bushkill River in Pennsylvania, which were mm-hmm. stocked, and between the two of us hook 125 trout in a day.
So Pennsylvania, that's right.
Thought we were lying, and people thought we were, you know, we were killing all these fish. We would rarely kill any.
Yeah.
Anyhow, back to the, you know, being chastised for, you know, when other guys were chasing girls around. Not that I didn't have my share of that.
Oh, yeah.
But really, you know, at the forefront always was fly fishing.
Uh-huh.
And it always has been.
Yep. That's
So it's been a lifelong love. And there's never been a struggle with that.
No.
I've never had problems learning it.
So you're back east. So basically mm-hmm. teenage years. So when did you make, because I think about when we first met, it's been a number of years now long, but mm-hmm. but when did you make the move out west from?
1977.
Okay, so 77. Yeah. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So 2 years after I was born, you...
Yeah. And I met your dad shortly thereafter.
Oh, you did?
When he had his fly shop down, you know, in East Portland, a little bit farther, 172nd and mm-hmm. Halsey. And he had Marty Sherman working with him then, and your mom, of course, was there. And you guys were all... You guys are just all little
rugrats,
guys.
You know? Rugrats, yeah.
But, you know, your dad was extremely helpful when it came to learning the steelhead fish to fly.
Yeah.
You know, as we all know, he was one of the pioneers to do that.
Yeah.
And Doug Stewart,
you
know, pioneer of the Max Canyon fly, the Stewart, all those flies.
Yeah.
And to this day, if I'm steelhead fishing, those are my go-to flies.
You still use the Max?
They are still my go-to flies, no matter where
That's
I'm
cool.
at.
Yeah.
And they produce fish.
Yeah.
They still do.
Yeah.
But yeah, I came here in 1977. I had a job in the Forest Service. I was still in college and I accepted that job. And I lived in Cottage Grove for a few weeks. And
so why did you come out here? Why?
It was for the fishing.
It was, because Pennsylvania, and I've interviewed some huge mm-hmm. people, you probably know Joe Brooks.
Mm-hmm. Well, right? I knew of him. I've met Joe Humphreys.
Joe Brooks. I meant Joe mm-hmm. Humphreys. So I interviewed Joe Humphreys, mm-hmm. and we talked about Pennsylvania and how, I mean, Pennsylvania is a super hot spot for fly fishing.
It's got excellent fly fishing.
And those guys spend their life there. But you, I mean, so why west? So fishing, what? There must have been something that...
You know, without getting into personal matters, you know, I realized... there was a stream I fished called the Assapin Creek, and at one time it had native brook trout in it, and it ran through, you know, hardwood stands, you know, not particularly gorgeous stands, but it was, you know, within six, seven miles of where I live, so I was able to ride my bike out there and catch fish. And one of the things that caused that impasse in my decision to move was they inadvertently poisoned it by, you know, breaking ground for a new division in its headwaters.
Gotcha.
I never thought that was, you know, an intentional poisoning, but
yeah.
according to the information that was available then, they struck an arsenic deposit and poisoned that stream.
Damn.
And the other, I actually used to, you know, trap a little bit and catch bass and crappie and other, you know, pickerel and stuff like that mm-hmm. at a nearby lake that eventually was essentially filled in.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just an early decision in my life that, this human development and all these things that are going on around me are not suitable for the lifestyle that I'm going to pursue.
Had you been out west before you made the move?
I had.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had. I spent some time, you know, with money in my pocket, hitchhiking around and when you could still do that.
Oh, really?
A little bit of that, you know, some of that, some of just bus rides, some planes, you know, and some driving myself. Explored the west for a couple of years, actually, before I moved here. Yeah. But I never had been in the Portland area.
Yeah.
I had been to the east side of the mountains, like in the Bend area a little bit, and then up into Washington. And anyway, I made that decision to move very early in my life.
You knew you were coming.
I knew I was going to be moving west. Yeah.
You just didn't know exactly where.
I didn't. Yeah. And as chance has it, I filled out applications when I was in college for the Forest Service, really in a haphazard manner.
Sure.
You know, some guy named Richard approached me with these forms. He said, hey, you know, you're thinking about moving west here. You know, you might fill these out, see what becomes of it. And it was forgotten for easily 6 months until I received the call.
There you go.
That, hey, you can have a job in the Umpqua National Forest if you can get here in 7 days.
Nice.
Well, 7 days wasn't easy, you know,
back then to
pack in. You know, I left my second semester in college early. And,
oh, you did?
I mean, my second year last semester.
And you drove out?
And drove out immediately and been here since. But I filled out applications from Alaska to Montana, Oregon, Idaho, Washington, Northern California. And I really wanted to go to Montana.
Yeah.
But that didn't work out.
No.
So, as it panned out, it was a fine decision to.
Yeah. What'd you do in the Forest Service? Job.
Well, I was hired as a hydrologist. Even though I was at my second year of college, I wasn't quite qualified for that.
Yeah.
But the applications for the Forest Service in those days added such things as, you know, favorite hobbies such as skiing, mountain climbing. You know, fishing, fly fishing, you know, fishing in general, hunting, you know, all these things, whitewater rafting.
They
took all those things into consideration, I think.
Yeah.
And they, for that reason, you know, I filled out and, you know, I actually filled the slot for a lot of those things. And so, you know, I was hired that, but generally speaking, you know, I was part-time help.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, we just gathered brush and threw them in piles, and you know, we fought a lot of fires. And
oh,
stuff
you did!
Like that.
Also, the fire, yeah.
Yeah, everybody in the Forest Service is required to fight fires, at least back in the 70s when I was there. So, but the you know, and the pay was absolutely horrible. And,
was it?
You know, I can't say right now. I'd probably be retired and doing well. But
that's true. Yeah, you would be.
And I wasn't used to that. But the upside to it was I discovered a lot of really cool, you know, remote
little
creeks and lakes
North
and stuff
Umpqua,
like that.
Were you down there?
No, we didn't do a lot of that. We were based out of Cottage Grove.
Oh, right.
Cottage
Grove office.
So we did some in the Umpqua drainage.
Which is cool because now...
Steamboat.
Yeah, I was just going to say, because now you have, I mean, you got a good group of people you know down there. In fact, we went down there once, remember?
Yeah. Yeah.
Went down to your buddy, I can't remember all the names, but and then even down to like Chiloquin and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you pretty much introduced me to that area.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so you had that early Forest Service, but you've, after that, stayed.
Yeah, you know, there was definitely benefits of working for the Forest Service. I don't regret that at all. It was, you know, it was quite an adventure.
Yeah.
There was, but again, you know, I got to know some country that a lot of people probably never would have.
Yeah.
Found some hot springs that, you know, that were, just absolutely off the charts, gorgeous and remote.
And hardly anybody.
And to these days, I'm not sure if anybody can find them.
No.
They're
really hard. Early 80s, there's probably not a ton of people.
There wasn't.
I mean, Cottage Grove must have been a super tiny little town.
It was.
Like a logging town or something.
It was. Yeah. It was, yeah. It was. Nice little town.
So that's it. So you basically come, so Forest Service, you get here, you're in the Forest Service for a couple of years or how?
2 years.
Yeah, 2 years. So then how?
That's part time.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what's this? That brings you into the like the early 80s. When do you start? Because now you've done this finished carpentry. How did you get into that?
Well, as a means to try to make money to get myself through college and, you know, other ventures.
Yep.
You know, my dad had taught me parts of the trade.
Oh, really? He was a carpenter?
So, yeah, he was a cabinet builder.
Oh, there you go.
And general carpenter. and amongst other things. He's really good with his hands.
So your dad was like a huge influence for you.
He was.
Fly fishing, absolutely. Carpentry.
Yeah.
And did you, when you left in 77, did you, I mean, your dad stay in good contact with them? Or where was he when you left?
They stayed in Jersey, which they remained to.
Same with your brother, right? Your brother was there. And your
my brother and sister. After I moved, I was here, I think it was 3 years, my sister decided to move.
Oh, that's right, your sister came
And
out.
So she's still here in Oregon, has a nice family
that's
and
right.
all those things.
So, but your dad was there and he...
They stayed there. My brother stayed there with him. And, you know, they did well there.
So yeah.
New Jersey is not a terrible place, contrary to some people's beliefs. It could be worse.
That's right. I asked somebody, I was talking to somebody from New York, who was it, on a recent interview, and he had the same thing as you, actually, the same exact thing. He said, Richard Harrington, you probably don't know, but he has this other Steelhead podcast. And he basically, his story was he was born out in Willalas, and because of his family, they took him back to New York, and he was like, man, I did not want to leave Oregon. And he made a vow, he was like, I am coming back to Oregon as soon as I can. 40 years later, because he met a woman, and she didn't want to leave, and they had kids and all that, so 40 years later, his kids give him say, you know what? Dad, go back to Oregon. Mm-hmm. So he moves back to Oregon.
Oh, good for him.
You know, I mean, a different story than yours, but I mean, it's the same thing, like the power of the West. And I grew up here, so for me, it's just natural.
Well, let me just say that, I've never regretted doing that.
Yeah.
But I do have to say that there is some really, really interesting and great fishing on the East Coast.
That's right.
There really is. Yeah. As soon as I was able to drive, I was headed to the Pennsylvania streams, Pine Creek, Slate Creek, Penn's Creek. I fished all of those creeks, and they have very good fishing on them.
Browns?
Some of them, Rainbow's Brown, some at Brook Trout, in those days. A lot of those streams didn't fish well in the summer.
Yeah,
a spring and a fall fishery, and in a lot of cases, those streams were closed all winter long.
Oh, wow.
In those days, and then I discovered the Catskills.
Oh, wow!
And that was pretty much a done deal.
What was that like?
Fishing? I should add, my folks were really flexible when it came to traveling. They had the traveling bug themselves. So our family was always going somewhere camping. You know, we went to New Hampshire, we went to Maine, Michigan, some places in Canada.
So you were camping for your
family. We were exposed to a lot of places.
Not traveling, you weren't doing other types of, your vacation was camping.
Camping.
That's
it was
cool.
Mostly revolved around camping.
That's cool.
There was, mom wanted to go see the knickknacks.
Sure.
But that notwithstanding, mostly my interests were, are we going to be near a lake or some kind of water,
even if it's
a puddle, so I can wet a line. But back to the New York fishery. So we explored northern New York, the Ausable, or I'm not sure how you say that.
Ausable. Right.
The Michigan one and the New York one. I always get the pronunciation backwards, perhaps. But but the Beaverkill, Willowemuck, and East Branch, Delaware offer some outstanding trout fishing, and it's super traditional.
Catskills.
The Catskills. And I actually, at one point, and I don't know that if Walt was still with us, I met Walt, Daddy and his wife. And
you did?
Yes, and I became pretty good friends with them early in my life.
I just talked to his son on the phone this week.
Yeah, I can't think of her name now, but they were very, very, very nice people and willing to share any kind of information, especially when it came to fly time.
I was just going to say, did you learn from
I that? Learned how to tie a proper March Brown from,
see, and that's
from
what I
Walt learned. Daddy's wife, and
no
I can't
kidding.
Remember her name, yes.
See, that's why you are always, and I'm glad you hit on this because I want to talk about this because I've never been a great dry fly tire. Because mainly my dad never taught me. I was never really that interested in it. But you were always really good with the dry flies. I wanted to ask you about that. So you learned from one of the greatest.
Well, it was more the materials, I think, for her. At that time, since I moved at 77, and I had been back in the late 80s at some juncture, for a short, two-day stay. But I never saw Walt or his wife again. But at that time, when I was fishing there, which was the early 70s, Their fly shop was a house.
That's right.
It wasn't really a fly shop.
No
you
kidding.
Walked, you knocked on the door or rung the bell like you were going to your neighbor's to borrow a cup of sugar.
Yeah.
And it was, come in, please, you know. And
right.
oh, and yeah, and then so their fly shop was, as I remember it, you walked through the living room area where there were some rods and reels and some memorabilia.
Yeah.
But then you walked through some entry doors, and then you were into their tying room,
no
their desk, you know, with... you know, materials and stuff like that. It was very, 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 very mom and pop.
That's cool.
And really warm, a warm, fuzzy feeling when you went in there. And they took me under their tutelage to some extent, you know, which I wasn't sure who I was actually talking to. And then I just thought there were some people that, you know, that owned this little fly shop.
And because and by then they were pretty known.
I think it was Roscoe that where they were in.
They were known for being great.
They were. Yeah. And they, you know, knew all the traditions and they were well connected, you know, within the fly fishing community.
That's right. Oh, yeah.
So, you know, I got to meet and fish with Ernie Schwiebert,
you
know, a few times. Yeah. That was through the Trout Unlimited chapter, which I was a sergeant at arms.
Isn't that cool, Trout Unlimited, because I'm kind of involved now. I mean, they've been around way back then, you know, to your childhood. You remember them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still just as strong. In fact, they're probably they're probably the biggest fish conservation organization in the country.
That's good to hear.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So TU's right now, I can tell you, just as strong as they've ever been. Probably the strongest.
I'm happy to hear that because we need all the help we can get.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah,
it's, but, you know, getting back to the New York, you know, New Hampshire offered some really great fish in Pemigewasset, the Seco, and if I'm pronouncing some of these incorrectly, excuse me, it's been years since I've been up there.
Yeah.
But some really great places there. But the West had something that I wanted, which was the big wide open spaces and the lack of people.
Mm-hmm.
As it gets crowded more and more these days, you're seeing a little bit less of that. But you can still get away from that, get away from the crowds. And, you know, for instance, on the Beaver Kill, I remember more or less standing in line waiting to get into Hendrickson's pool so I could cast a fish because it was almost like a gilly thing where you had to wait till the guy waded through it in front of you. It might be an hour before you could fish.
And this was back then?
Back in the 70s, yeah.
And what's it like now? Because you were just over... where were you at, in Montana?
Oh, no, that's Montana.
You're talking the Beaver.
I'm back.
I was thinking, what's New York. The Beaver? What am I thinking of in Montana? I guess
Beaverhead.
Gotcha.
Yeah, Montana's still great. It really is.
My
wife and I spent almost a month there recently, and we fished in a lot of places, kind of like a whirlwind tour.
Oh, really?
Because our main goal was to visit with my brother, who's now residing in Billings in an apartment.
Yeah.
So we hooked up with him on the Yellowstone and this and that and the other thing.
Yeah.
But Montana still has fabulous fishing.
There's still only, less than a million people there or something?
Not sure. I'm hearing that there's 40,000 new license plates every year,
there's
a lot of population.
What's Billings like?
I'm not qualified probably. My observation is that it's kind of I think it has its heritage is mining, you know, logging, stuff like that. So it's more of an industrial area.
Gotcha.
I mean, it's a nice town. I mean, there's a lot of really good things to say about Billings, but I'm not qualified to, to give an assessment of it that's accurate.
No. Did you do any dry fly fishing while you were there?
I did pretty much nothing but dry fly fishing.
So let's talk about this a little bit.
Where it was available. Unfortunately, I was there in August and through early September, and there's just too much going on with hatches.
Yeah.
But if you consider, fishing ants and hoppers, and, things like big fluffy flies like royal wolves and
I just interviewed Dave Whitlock and he was like, well, let's talk about terrestrials.
Uh-huh.
You know, Dave's hopper, he's got I think he's got an ant pattern. Mm-hmm. So what did you guys fish? I mean, did you have one pattern that was
High tie hopper pattern that I like. It's very much like Dave's pattern.
Is it?
Yeah. I don't have one handy to show you, but I did buy some store bought patterns from a place in Missoula. And I can't remember his name. I'd like to give him some good kudos
Now. To think
of Grizzly.
Oh, Grizzly. You went to the Grizzly.
Yeah,
Grizzly.
And the proprietor, the owner slash whatever, was very, very graceful.
Cool.
Really helpful with great information.
Awesome. I'll put a link in the show notes to their
place. And the grasshopper patterns he gave me were really great. And so, also some ant patterns. They were very productive.
So if you talk about terrestrials, wherever you're fishing, I'm not sure where you're at, but I mean, what's the key? Did you catch some fish on terrestrials?
I did. Unfortunately for me, it was just my wife and I, and so I'm the only one that can row a boat.
Oh, right.
You know, floating to Clark Fork or the Bitterroot or any of those, you know.
You want to be able to be you need to
drift and float to cover the right amount of water.
The bank, get right off the bank.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was limited to that to some extent. Floating to Clark Fork, I had some pretty good success with hoppers and ants. Where I just stop and anchor up and wait, or waiting the bank. And doing that. Some nice fish in the Clark Fork.
What are your, if you just generally speaking, say your top five dry flies, if you just had to, just general, whether you're going to Montana or, you know, Oregon, how much is it vary?
You know, I'm quite a traditionalist, you know, so, you know, in older school, there are so many great patterns out right now that sometimes it's mind boggling. I can't keep up with it. Some of them really, I think, catch fishermen, but I'm not sure how many fish they catch.
That's right.
So, you know, I have my, if you will, bastardized versions of some of the more popular flies, like Parachute Adams, if that's where we're going with this.
Yeah, for sure.
Of course, terrestrials, ants. Yeah. I have this theory, and it's a homespun one, that trout somehow get high on ants. They love ants.
Oh, really?
I've been in lake situations many times when there's absolutely nothing going on and a flying ant hatch occurs and every trout on the lake will blast them like a shark eating a penguin.
Wow.
You know, they just love ants.
So a flying, you're talking in lakes, dry flies?
Small ants, big ants, it doesn't matter. Red, black, cinnamon, on the surface,
Well, and what fly, is there a name or just does it matter?
I just tie a regular old ant pattern with, you know, wings and a black hackle in the middle. You know, when it comes to ants, unless perhaps, maybe like if you're a Henry Forks guy or a Spring Creek guy where they see a lot of bugs, they may be particular.
Yeah.
But in my, you know, experience, especially on lakes or like when there's an overwhelming, like a windy day on some place like the Deschutes, I've seen that.
Yeah.
Where there's all of a sudden just a lot of flying ants or termites, you know. To me, they're the same thing. I'm sure fish don't decipher the difference either. They just go haywire.
So they're blowing on the river and they just
and even if they haven't seen them for a couple hours, they'll still blow them up.
Nice.
I've never seen, in fact, there's been times on Crane Prairie Reservoir where we've seen flying ants hit the water and I've run out of ant patterns and put on a black gnat.
Right.
And just, they slurp it. They just blow it up.
Yeah.
You know,
so
one twitch and it goes down.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, so getting back to the pattern selection, you know, probably an ant, for sure grasshopper.
Hopper.
And back in the old days, we used to just use mother minnows. And in fact, your dad at one point said to me, and this is many, many years ago, but I'll never forget, he said, you know, Gene, try putting a little bit of red throat, a little red in your
hopper?
No, in your muddler minnow.
Oh, in your muddler.
And back into the chutes, you know, we had a lot more bigger fish then. We still plenty of fish there, but, you know, I could walk up way to bank with just a greased hopper with a little bit of red in it, and they just destroyed that thing.
No kidding.
Yeah, huh?
So your muddler, you're down.
That was floating.
Floating.
Yeah, we put greased the crap out of them, so they just float as high. One thing about hoppers is if the water's really smooth, and this is a tip for anybody out there, is you want to make sure that hopper, in most cases, if the water's smooth, that rides really high up on top.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid to grease them and get them up on their legs, because when they start to sag down in the water, you start to get refusals.
Gotcha.
So it's a good thing to get them greased up and up high, yeah, and, huh, you know, twitching them and all that stuff. But so, you know, of course, an elk hair caddis.
Yeah.
And you know, as an attractor pattern, I've always done good with humpies.
Oh, and humpies, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yellow humpies. You get me on the humpies too. That's right. Humpies are good, yeah, lake patterns. And are they good stream for river patterns?
Yeah, they're just good. I think I've just always had.
All around, yeah.
You can always seem to get a trout to rise to one of those flies.
And red, black.
Red or yellow,
yeah,
usually.
Red or yellow. Yeah, red, yeah, or yellow. Okay.
Yep. Sometimes green.
Okay. So that gives us, that's like six top.
Is that flag. Six?
Yeah, I think. Yeah. I can't remember the first one. I think it was, what was the first one? It wasn't
Parachute Adams.
Yeah, Parachute Adams. Parachute Adams. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and you mentioned my dad again. I did want to hit on this because my dad is obviously, you guys had, you met my dad in the 70s. When did you guys do your first trip? It was probably on the Deschutes, right? When was your first trip?
No. Our first trip together was on the Sandy.
Oh, no kidding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when was that? Do you remember what, roughly?
He guided me. I approached him in the shop because I had been catching steelhead.
Uh-huh.
But in a haphazard fashion, I was using all these East Coast methods. I was actually using like a skunk. I didn't. I was not hip to egg patterns yet. I was fishing the skunk with a couple split shot, just dead drifting it like a nymph.
Gotcha.
Not even swing, just like swing. Like a high stick type of thing. And of course, I was catching them then, but not in the same fashion as guys like your dad, Marty Sherman, and Frank Amato, and Jim, and those guys were swinging flies, and it was exciting. You know, it was intriguing to me because of that. The size of the fish and the aggressiveness of in that yank
is—I
mean, the tug is the drug, and I didn't have an inkling of how to do that. No. And there was not a lot written about it then. And of course, we had no YouTube or any of those.
Do you remember Trey Combs back in the day?
I do.
Yeah,
I met Trey a couple of times.
He was probably the one guy that had a book out.
He did.
He was writing some stuff back in the day.
Yeah. Yep. And. There was a lot of stuff done in Southwest Washington. I can't think of all the authors. Yeah.
McMillan.
Bill McMillan. Yeah, you know,
there was also what's his name down in Eugene. Got a fly shop in Salem at the time.
He invented this. He had the Scarlet Ibis for a while.
And he got. I just talked to him. He got busted for. That was a really interesting story. He got busted for fly tying for bringing by the feds.
He
told the story how he showed up and ate.
I've heard
cars were. He told all things.
I've heard several stories, but I'd like to hear the clarification. Because I can just envision me tying flies in my shop.
He cleared the air and told his story. And you know John Shuey, who I've also had on. I went to John. Me and John, we talked a little bit. I said, John, I just had. I can't believe I'm drawing a blank on his name. But I said, I just had him on the show, and John was like, you know what? That's his side of the story. I'm not quite sure if it's the whole truth, but...
A fisherman that doesn't lie.
Exactly.
Imagine that.
Exactly. I'm going to find this just because I don't want to miss this. I'll put it in the show notes, too. But it was a really great conversation because he probably went off for 20 minutes on that story. And then as we got through it, he said, okay... Now let's get back to fishing and talking about fishing. I missed it, but I'll put it in. Dave McNeese.
That's right.
Yeah, Dave McNeese. And it was just classic because he still has a steelhead hook that he invented that people love. Blue heron, I think it's called blue heron steelhead hooks. Mm-hmm. But anyways, I want to get back to my dad and that whole story. But
yeah.
So
he taught me to swing flies.
So swing flies.
Yeah. And even on the Deschutes.
Yeah.
Of course, the fishing... For steelhead then was crazy. It was phenomenal.
What was it like in the early, in the 80s?
I had been invited to go to Alaska and DC many times. And, you know, my response is, why?
Really? So you'd go out there and...
We were catching. My best day on the Deschutes is 27 steelhead hooks.
No kidding.
Yeah, that was in the September 23rd, 1983.
83.
Mm-hmm. And but I still didn't really know how to swing flies for steelhead correctly. I tried it, you know, I really wasn't, you know, getting it. And one of your dad's favorite lines was, you know, well, you just cast it down and across and you hang on to your shorts.
Exactly. That's right.
And, you know, that's classic Doug Stewart, you know.
Yeah.
But he was the guy who took me he actually took a friend of mine, George Miller. We're still good friends. Okay. I did a trip with your dad down to Sandy, or did the side channel, which we used to fish.
So you hiked in.
We hiked in.
From the hatchery.
It was a very successful trip.
It was?
We hooked fish, and he was showing me how to fish flies on a sinking line then.
And what sinking? So was this the teeny, like the T300 sinking line?
Yeah, he was used. I think at that time it wasn't the teeny line because we were still all messing around with. No, there were still hybrid lines. We were still dinking around.
Yeah.
Now, Teeny had come out with his line, but it was right in that same time period.
And now a quick word from our sponsors. The Fly Fishing and Tying Journal has a great fall edition that's out right now. You can find Lucas Stevens, who visits Winston Fly Rods in the fall edition, for an insider look and a rare interview with Ted Leeson. Patrick Wall pays homage to Harry Lemire's Tide in Hand Atlantic Salmon Flies. Boots Allen takes us to the pond with a masterclass in Stillwater. Dennis Dabo also travels to Scotland in search of salmon. Good to have him on here. I'd love if you could stop by right now and just press pause. Head over to wetflyswing.com/FTJ and subscribe to the magazine. You'll get that issue delivered to your door. That's wetflyswing.com/FTJ. We're also supported by SoFly Gear, led by Chief Apparel Guru and Team USA Youth Fly Fishing member James Carlin, who has a great clothing line that you're definitely going to love. SoFly's mission is to produce clothes that look good, perform well, and can be worn on and off the water. Plus, most importantly, are manufactured under sustainable methods. They do this with bamboo. This shirt has a great mixture. I've been wearing it. It all around. It dries quick. It stays warm. It's soft. It's good to go. Pretty amazing stuff. You got to check it out. So if you can, you can head over to wetflyswing.com/sofly and get started today. That'll help support James and the podcast in one shot. That's wetflyswing.com/sofly. Okay, back to the show.
Did you ever use the teeny lines?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and I still do.
And you still do?
I still have some to this day, yeah. And they're fish-catching lines. But your dad was, you know, the very... Swinging flies for steelhead is an art that I think a lot of people really don't understand. Line speed is extremely critical, and it's overlooked.
Yeah.
In any kind of a scenario where you're trying to swing flies for steelhead on a sinking tip or sinking line... It's so critical, you know, and it's people talk about the presentation, but that line speed is everything. And your dad taught me how to correctly cast, you know, mend and use the correct line speed. And it was a huge revelation for me.
What was the, when you think about correct line speed, I mean, how do you get, what did he show you that, you know what I mean? Like, what is correct line? How do you even know?
Well, the first thing he taught me was, reading the water correctly. Looking at the speed of the water out in front of you, whether it's slower close to you or faster out, you know, those kinds of things. Braided currents are extremely hard to fish, even though they can hold, you know, steelhead. And he would teach me such things as, Gene, you know, don't cast so far across at the 90 degree thing. Make sure you're getting it down at 3/4, you know, in braided water or really slow water. Hey, throw it up a little bit, put a downstream end in it, so we're picking up the right line speed. And I've watched your dad, you know, not recently because he's older and we haven't fished together as much, but I watched your dad go and fish places that were really difficult for other people to fish and hook fish in there.
Right.
You know, and to me, I was just perplexed.
Right.
You know, it's like, wow, this cat.
Yeah,
he can get it done.
That's the thing. There's something about that. He was, you know, with my dad. I think the secret is that, you know, there's this athletic ability. It's funny because he was kind of almost a pro athlete, and I've talked to so many people now, over 160 people that are some of the best in the world fly fishermen, right? And there's this theme of, you know, for example, you know this guy. Who's the lake guy down south?
Danny Rickards.
I had Danny Rickards on. We talked, and Danny Rickards broke out such a great episode. He took lake fishing and just made it so clear for everybody to take it in. And but the cool thing was, like, we talked about baseball, and he was this close to pro baseball.
Athletic people have a tendency to be to have a head start. Let's say
that's true, right? So, I mean, and you have a little bit of.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. What was your sport?
Oh, I played a lot of sports, yeah. but basketball mostly.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I ran track, yeah. a lot of that.
So you got to say that.
But a lot of basketball, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
And, you know, we played all sports. I was born in a neighborhood where there was like 73 kids on our block.
We joke about this because you're a Shropshire, right? You came up, you've got that... you know, it's like the mob, right? You're the whole thing. I mean, what was it like?
You know, that's overdone.
That's overdone. Yeah. But what was it like? I mean, take us back again. We're swinging back around. But to growing up, were you in, you know, what was that like in Jersey? Were you around people that were kind of real, like legit?
Yeah. There were, I was surrounded by really awesome people and awesome families. Yeah. I had no idea what I had.
Yeah.
You know, because it was just automatic.
Yep.
You know, the people were great that I grew up with. All my friends there were really great. My high school conditions were great. You know, so many people have these cliques and I couldn't wait to get out of high school.
You liked it.
I cried when I got out of high school. That everybody, all the black, Hispanic people, the white people, we were all really
close. So it was a diverse, so it wasn't like, so you had, you know, the Catholic.
It was very diverse.
Really, and everything was mixed. There wasn't these big, there wasn't these big, like, you know, you're whatever, you're this, so we don't talk to you.
Not much. No, it was extraordinary.
Wow.
And, you know, I didn't realize what I had.
Because it's different in Oregon, right? I mean, Oregon looked around a little bit, right?
I was here in my I came here in my early 20s, and I was kind of secluded being in the Forest Service. So I wasn't exposed to a lot of those things.
Yeah.
Like back there, but no, it was a great place to grow up.
Yeah.
I don't regret a bit being back there. Yeah. I met my wife Nancy.
Oh, really?
Back there.
That's right. Yeah, so. Nancy's.
Anyhow, so that's been a great success and good life. So, but your dad has taught me a lot of things when it comes to that, you know, approach and. I have a tendency as a fly caster to be impatient. You know, I'm still hell bent on catching fish. You know, it doesn't have to be the biggest and the most, but I'm still.
Yeah,
it's kind of built into me. Where your dad was a lot more patient.
A
very fluent caster.
Yeah,
your dad would oftentimes say, "Gene, why don't you just sit down for a while and just enjoy the scenery around you?"
Yeah,
you know. Of course, I'm 18 younger than years younger than he is. So all in that, he's 80.
Are you really? Yeah, you are. That's right. He was born in 39. When were you born?
In 54.
Oh,
so,
wow. No kidding.
Yeah. So 15 years
you're
apart.
You're 15 years younger. Yeah, so you're...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Dang.
So he taught me a lot about that, you know. It was really actually... It was actually, in a lot of ways, a turning point in my angling because I became less aggressive.
Yeah.
And just, you know, fishing with him for the years that we did, you know, it was like, hey, you know, sit down, enjoy this, you know, for a minute.
That's cool. That, you know, I never thought about that much, that my dad was like that, because I think I told the story once where I watched him get in a fight on the river one time, because he had that side of him too.
Been there a couple times.
Yeah, well, what was the deal with that?
Oh, I don't really want to share those moments, but, you know, there are a few incidences that we were quite, looking back on them, as always, you know, hindsight's always 20/20.
There's alcohol probably mixed
probably in there. More than likely. No, definitely.
Yeah, I've heard people say that where they're like, okay, you know, without alcohol, I'm this person. And with alcohol, it's like I just change.
Most of those arguments were based on like fighting over water or.
Exactly. And it's still to me, my friends.
Or like people who were just rude and we.
Yeah, right.
I was bootleg guiding back there at early age too. And he was legitimately guiding.
Right.
I was bootleg guiding. Yeah. You know, I can say this now, BLM. So
it's
way over. You know, we're so much water. And you know, even though there was an extraordinary amount of traffic on the Deschutes, then people would still fight for the best steelhead runs. Okay. Didn't happen in trout water.
No.
But the steelhead runs were. You know, it was fairly common to fish if you knew what you were doing to swing a fly on the Deschutes. And hook a half a dozen to a dozen fish between two guys in an evening.
Yeah, and so...
Very common.
And so, and I'm thinking, I always go back to our camp, which is known now, you know, Stewart's Camp. We don't even, never even call it that,
but
now you go
Upper Lockett or
Boxcar. In fact, it just happened
Boxcar,
this last year, we were out there, and somebody came down, And they said, oh, we were going to camp down there, but we heard that was Stewart's camp.
That's great.
Yeah, I know. I was like, oh, man, that's
great.
And that all goes back to my dad and stuff. But when I think of that water, because it just seems like, I mean, obviously there's less fish than there used to be right now, but it just seems like the water doesn't produce as much as, I mean, what do you remember about that water? That run.
Well,
do you remember that being a very productive
run? It was, in my opinion, it was the top 10 runs.
There you go.
It was in the top 10 runs on the Deschutes River. And at times, it could be, the fish will hold, they would hold in that whole stretch.
And because what part? So not just the top, not the middle, not
the whole thing.
The whole thing. You would fish the whole thing.
From knock-knock all the way down.
Yeah.
Or jet pump. Yeah, you know, some people call it knock-knock. Yeah. But from Jet Rapids all the way down to what I named the two butthole. The two cigarette butthole.
Oh, which one is that?
That's the next one down from the boxcar.
Oh yeah, so that's above. That's just.
That's below, where you run out of water.
Goddamn, run on the other side.
Yeah, that's right.
Rock. So the grassy spot.
It's just above the grassy spot.
Just above the grassy.
Yeah, it's not the grassy
spot. Oh, yes, the riffle.
It's a little riffle.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
Call that the two cigarette butthole because you throw it after two smokes.
Totally. Yeah. When I go now because it has been tough, the one spot I go where I know I can probably hook a fish is that one.
Yeah.
That's the one I
just
It's a go-to spot.
And they'll hold in there,
too. And you're only waiting this deep.
Yep. It's a picture of Jim, that Jim Colantino took me in here.
Yeah, somewhere.
It's somewhere here in the archives. Jim and I pulled down there because there was somebody in your dad's spot.
Yep.
This was a deer trip many years ago.
Oh, yeah. This was Jim Colantino.
Jim Colantino.
Who's still around somewhere, too.
I saw Jim recently, cool. In Maupin.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I was rowing Jim down, and we came down around the... Past, you know, your dad's spot, the box car we used to call it, lock,
which is burned,
you know, and there were fish rolling everywhere, steelhead. They were just rolling all through that, and I couldn't get in that spot because there was people camped there. It was the beginning of the deer trip, and back in the 90s somewhere.
Yeah, Who knows?
The photograph is labeled, but Jim and I came down through there, and Jim at that point had not landed a steelhead yet on a fly.
Yeah.
So I said, Jim, this is your chance. We pulled over at this two butthole.
Yeah.
And Jim said, no, lad, you go ahead and do it. You know, Jim.
Yeah.
And I said, no, Jim, come on. This is your chance. Yeah. It's your big chance. And I mean, literally, there were, dozens, if not 50 steelhead rolling.
That's the easiest spot.
And we had maybe 20 minutes of light left.
Yeah.
Damn. You know. So I was rigged up, and we both were actually in gym. No, lad, I'm going to set up to camp you fish.
Yeah.
And it was the only time in my life that I've made 7 casts and hooked 7 steelhead.
Wow.
And we have pictures of some of them there.
No kidding.
But you couldn't even get a short cast out without a fish eating a fly.
Yep.
And that's never happened to
me. That's what's cool about that room, because it comes out of this shallow riffle and then dumps into the slot, which eventually goes out into a deeper, slow water.
But hold right there.
But you got this little window of area
And they were there. They were fish rolling right around my waders.
Damn. You know? Wow.
But so your dad taught me a lot about, and also the Deschutes River. The lower Deschutes, your dad taught me most of, you know, the hazards, the runs, you know.
So you went down, when he went down, what was your first trip down the lower Deschutes?
George Miller and your dad.
So you went down in my dad's boat.
We went down in the Yellow Raft.
Yellow Raft?
Yeah.
Didn't he have a drift boat back then? I thought he had a Koffler.
No, he went down in the raft that time.
No kidding.
Yeah.
You three in a yellow raft.
Yeah.
Okay. And
then next time we went down in the strip boat.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was Ray's.
Oh, by then he had the Ray's. Oh, wow, this is already into Ray's. That's right, because he sold Koffler boats for a while.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
You know, he may have had the Koffler boat then. I can't remember the boat. I was so excited about the steelhead fishing.
Yeah.
And it was a great trip.
It was.
We still didn't, George and I still didn't know, you know, how to swing a fly properly. But we dumped in at, I'll never forget this, and I still have pictures of it.
Yeah.
The three of us dumped in at, and I think this was the drift boat, at the Rock Garden at Max Canyon.
Oh yeah, across
right
Max.
across.
You just went in there.
We went right in there, and there were fish rolling everywhere. Damn. Your dad immediately hooked like a 12 pounder. I mean, like first cast.
Really?
And we hooked like, I can't remember, I'm not going to exaggerate, but it was at least 7 between the three of us before we even moved down river 100 feet.
Nice.
you know, there were fish everywhere. And all the way down, we hooked fish.
You're not even barely off the boat ramp. That's a great start. That's why that run is a good place to start.
At the boxcar, your dad and I hit 51 steelhead in a weekend down there. We took turns. We had a guide trip, which I helped him on. It was his trip. But they left, and we stayed and fished.
That
was in the probably the early 80s.
Early 80s, You know, it's interesting. I look now that we've had all this time has gone by, and we've seen the steelhead. You know, because the steelhead numbers have been doing this. And in the 80s, you were hitting it probably up here. Somewhere in the 90s, it started to tank back down. In the mid-90s, it's down here. Started to come back up because in the mid-2000s,
we had
I was fishing hard. We had a couple of days. I went, again, same thing. I went with a good buddy, me and my other two guys. We fished it over, I think it was a 3.5 day trip, and we had 50 fish.
Yeah.
And that was in the mid-2000s.
It's still possible in the lower
but,
river,
but
they
since
say.
Then, since then, it's gone back downhill.
Who knows? You know, I'd rather not get into the scientifics of what's going on there. But your dad taught me a lot, and I give him a lot of credit for that. Mostly steelhead fishing. The trout fishing thing.
That's right.
Even though the Western, you know, the Deschutes is unreliable in terms of hatches, and you know, except for perhaps the stonefly hatch and you know maybe the fall caddis hatch or you know it's
not
blue wing olives is pretty reliable all winter long or whatever, but there are, the other hatches are unreliable.
So you never got that excited about you fished trout?
No, I fished I almost exclusively fished trout on the Deschutes until I realized that these 6 and 7 pound fish that were ripping me up were steelhead. I didn't get that figured out. Your dad helped me with that too. You know, he's like, hey, you dumbass, you know, those aren't trout. Those are, you know, he actually thought the same thing with his dad. Many years ago, they thought they were catching big trout.
That's right.
On steelhead flies, you know, or on trout flies. That's how that whole
thing. That's exactly it,
as I understand it.
Yeah, that's the story. Yeah, that's it.
So, you know, had a lot of enjoyable trips and, you know, your dad was again taught me many things about
You know, and that's the power of the you know you think about the parents because my dad you know your dad had an influence on you my dad had a big influence on me now I'm having an influence on my girls you know and they're starting to get into hunting and stuff I had no you know I never even said anything about it, but just like they're just like you right you were around it I mean, if your dad was sitting here right now what would he be just was he just like you
No, he was a very subdued person you know he's pretty quiet pretty shy
so he wasn't a
you
talker
know? Not really
wasn't a bullshitter he wouldn't be going
you know he enjoyed life from the standpoint of you know just being honest he was an old school guy you know he wasn't in World War II. In the service or anything, but he was of that generation, you know, where people didn't use necessarily a lot of words to express themselves.
Gotcha.
They proved themselves by example and not, you know, not by, you know, braggery
that's
or if that's the right terminology to use. You know,
he was
a doer and not a talker.
That's right.
You know, that's when he talked, everybody listened.
Yeah. That's cool.
You know, so... Huh.
Nice. Well,
yeah.
And so, I mean, and we go back to it. So we're talking a little about steelhead. I mean, trout, there's a lot of places we go, but I mean, now you're, so what do you have going now when you look at the next, 5, 10 years, what's getting you excited when you think about fishing? Now?
Well, having the semi-retirement and then full retirement coming up in the near future, you know, I reflect on this summer, where since late May, I've been a trout bum.
Yeah.
My wife doesn't like that terminology, but
no, it's it.
It is what it is. I am a trout bum.
So you can just pack the car, pack the boat, and you're out there just camping. And
I've spent very little time sitting on my butt. It's been in a boat or standing in a river somewhere. I'm hoping I've never been happier with that.
No kidding.
It's great.
So you don't have anything tying you back to actually have to come back?
No, so, I wouldn't say that, but you know, it's, and it's good to come back. You know, I still enjoy woodworking. I'm going to continue doing limited amounts of work vocationally. And I, you know, cause I enjoy that facet of my life and my music is real important.
Yeah. And bird hunting too, right? You're still bird hunting?
Yeah. I'm an avid bird hunter.
Are you still?
We're leaving next week for almost 2 weeks with Don Stokes.
Is this the same, that old trip?
The Vail trip that you've been with us on.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, Yeah, in fact, you're invited to come this year if you like. Man.
Eventually, again, it comes back to like, I'm getting this point where it's so cool because, you know, my Juna's 8, she's going to be 9. Mm-hmm. And they're getting so into that range where they're going to be coming with me on everything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like, okay, I'm going on a trip. Here they are.
How cool.
And they're out doing as much as, you know, they're going to be out fishing me pretty soon.
It's in their blood.
I know.
It is.
And the cool thing I love about it is that the fact that it's cool because, you know, they're female. And I love the fact that it's like, that doesn't matter whatsoever. They're just as passionate as they, you know what I mean?
You know, when I was in Montana, and I think it's true throughout most of the West, but I noticed that there were a lot of male and male-female teams.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, there was a lot of guided trips, you know, on the Yellowstone. I saw quite a few. That's Upper Clark Fork, Bitterroot. The Blackfoot.
I saw
lots of you know, either husband, wife, girlfriend, boyfriend, you know, teams being guided there. And I'd love it. I love seeing that. I really think it's important. In fact, you know, I'm not a certified casting instructor, but I've done plenty of that, you know. But my easiest students have been women.
Yeah.
They don't have any preconceptions about casting. Yeah. And, for instance, you know, I didn't teach her to cast, but Marlon Rampey, my friend, the guide, one of the, I just have to say that in my opinion, he's one of the best guides in Southern Oregon when it comes to trout fishing. He's great.
And Marlon, that name has come up and he's big down there.
He's a great fisherman. Yeah. Marlon and I go way back. He still had fished with me back on the Deschutes, you know, a few times. But his wife Susan is like a work of art to watch her cast.
Yeah,
she has the most beautiful fluid motion. She's also athletic.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah,
she's a champion trap shooter.
Oh really.
So
back to hunting.
Back kind to of that.
Bird hunting and fly fishing go together, it seems
They seems like it, you know.
A lot of people. Shuey.
Yeah.
Shuey's a big bird hunter.
John Geerich.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
He is too? There you go. Before we get out of here, I just want to touch on the Southern Oregon. Because who's the old guy down there? There's a Native American guide, right? Who's the down in Southern? What's his? No.
I'm not sure. I know him.
What's his name?
Butch Breeding.
Yeah, there's one guy. I'll try to think of. There's a guy that somebody has told me about who's down there on the Klamath somewhere. But
I know who you're talking about. I met him. It's a father son team.
Yeah, I've been wanting to look him up and get him on because I think Marlon would probably be a good guy to talk to too.
Yeah,
right?
He would know. Or Randy might know
too. Yeah, because he's still guiding down there.
Marlon is. I just spoke with him last week. Okay. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Haven't had a ton. Like I said, we did a little bit on lakes. And I mean, you know, obviously we're not going to be able to get it because the lakes is a whole other thing, which you taught me a lot about.
I've been doing a lot of lake fishing. Montana was out of this world.
So that's why the motor. So the motor you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Drift boat with a motor does it all. It's not the fastest thing in the world.
And if it works out, this friend of yours, I'm excited because I've been thinking about getting a motor, so if I can come up with save a little money and get
we can make that happen.
That's cool.
I think he probably has 5 or 6 sitting there right now.
Shit, that's perfect.
Yeah.
Oh man, I'm sorry. In fact, Megan and the kids, they're all like, all right, let's go, let's get on the water. They're way more excited than me. They want to get in the drift boat, they want to get out, and I'd love to get out and
that's
walk
so good
right now.
That's great.
I know.
That's really great.
It's
more and more people need to get out. You know, I have mixed feelings about that, you know, because there's just so many people on the water these days that at times it becomes exasperating. You know, I wish that people would be more respectful of each other, you know, in a lot of ways.
Yep.
You know, they're more and more people cut you off and try to, you know, intrude in your water and all that stuff. Now, you know, it's become a situation where you need to be cognizant of it rather than just going outside. But with, you know, notwithstanding, seeing your gals get out like that, and again, seeing people get out in the water, that really appreciate it, respect it, you know, It's very encouraging.
I'm excited. Well, before we get out of here, I have this little thing called the 222, which is top two. Well, we talk about flies, but top two tips, top two flies, top two resources. And it's usually on a topic we're talking about. We've been talking a little bit about trout fishing and steelhead, and we talked about flies, I guess. You know, trout flies, you gave six here. If we stayed on that, would you want to give a couple of tips for more like dry fly fishing or steelhead? What do you think you could, do you have any tips that come to mind where you could help somebody if they're listening?
I think that mostly it's been touched on, but what I see people doing, especially in lake fishing, let's concentrate on that for a moment.
And that's, in fact, I wanted to talk lakes.
Because lakes are so problematic. It's just a whole nother world of thought, you know, the thought process. It's complicated.
Yeah.
And it changes like by the hour.
Really?
Yeah, it does. It can. Yeah. Let's put it that way.
Sure.
I see people a lot of times fish in lakes and they don't use long enough leaders. It's almost a rule of thumb, even with a sinking line. Now we're getting into semantics here, which I don't want to go into every example. But I see people fishing, like for instance, like a difficult lake to fish, like Crane Prairie Reservoir. It's clear water. You might have a favorite saying about Crane. Crane giveth and Crane taketh away. It can be just a mother to fish. It can be really difficult.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, I see that they're not using long enough leaders.
And what's a long enough?
At Crane, if the water's still 15 feet.
15 foot, at least.
And you want to use, and if you're fishing, especially a floating fly.
Yeah.
Usually 15 feet minimum. Yeah. If you get some riffle in the water and they're aggressive, you can come down from that. And the tip, it should be not less than 4 feet, and five feet's better.
And 6X or depending.
You have to go pretty fine. Yeah. You know, with some of the higher end fluorocarbons these days, you can go with a smaller diameter.
Yeah. Gotcha.
But beware that they are not as durable as some of the thicker, like Maxima is an extremely durable line, but it's got a thicker diameter.
It's thicker,
so you have to use this
long leader. What else for lakes would you tell somebody if they're going out, say they're in a, say they're in a drift boat, say they're just rowing around?
Yeah, I was going to say, you need to find the right spot in the lake.
Yeah, how do you do that?
Lakes, that's a difficult thing. You know, number one, I mean, I don't use a fish finder. I probably should.
I thought you had them.
And, they work to some extent, especially if the water's got some depth to it.
You know, Ricker said, and he broke it down very simply, he said, do not fish... And I've had other people contradict this, but he said, do not fish deep water. You want to catch those fish as they're coming in the shore to feed. Mm-hmm. So you want to be here as they're coming in. Mm-hmm. You want to catch them when they're coming in. That's what he said.
Well, especially where he fishes, which, by the way, Marlon Rampey is the guy who taught me how to fish the lakes down there. Doesn't make me any kind of an authority, but we do well.
Klamath Lake. And
The Klamath Lake. Agency Klamath and all those.
Yeah.
So I give, kudos to him for that. And he understands.
Where did you find Marlon? Does he have a website? Or
I believe it's
I'll put a link in the show notes.
I'm not sure, but I think it's Western Fly Fishing Adventures.
Okay, I'll find it. And
something like that.
The cool thing, now you're reminding me. Gosh, remember that trip we did to Williamson?
Yeah.
You took me down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I always talk, I don't talk about that, but I just remember it, that we went down there and that was such an amazing river. And we, hear and anchor, and you couldn't see anything. But and then agency, and then Klamath. I mean, that is an amazing area.
It's unique.
Yeah,
extremely different to fish. Huge fish.
Yeah.
And very different. The first, I fished down there back in the 80s.
Yeah.
And I spent weeks and weeks down there and never hooked a fish.
Yeah, shocked. Yeah. What's the secret down there? So long leader's probably there too.
No, in the water.
Just knowing where
you got to know where the water is. That's a different thing now. Okay. You know, the lakes are different, but Denny Rickard's assessment of fishing drop offs and fish passages are fairly accurate.
Yeah.
But you also look for cold water sources. You look for springs.
Okay.
You look for weed beds.
How could you find a spring? Maybe follow track vegetation.
Out in open water, one of the best ways to find a spring is look for bubbles.
Oh, there you go.
And then usually in spring areas, the water will be of course, clear.
Yeah.
You know, so if you have, so if you have, you know, different water clarities, a drastic, like if you're boating along or tubing along and all of a sudden you're in the middle of the lake and it goes from, you know, kind of a pea green or a lime green to clear, there's a spring somewhere.
Yeah.
And you want to try to mark those. A lot of times springs will appear like in a rocky bottom or a weedy area, and there, because of the nature of springs, they blow sand or what up out of the substrate, and so you'll have a clear area. You know, it can be from a few inches around to 30, 40, 50 feet around. So those are places to look for. Leeward parts of the lake, especially if it's windy and you don't know the lake.
So leeward is, what is that?
You want to go to the windy end of the lake and fish.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's where the food will get
blown down there. So even though it's choppy and nasty, it still won't be there.
In bigger lakes, that's not necessarily the case. You're not going to have a fish that's going to swim 2 miles to the other end of the lake to eat, you know, say, blown in ants. But but in smaller lakes, you know, that's happened to me like in places like Gold Lake in the Oregon Cascades, you know, fly fishing lake. Lava lakes and you know, stuff like that.
Okay, this is good. So so lake, so we got so two, and then what if we go to two patterns? What are your favorite lake patterns?
Well, one's got to be a woolly bugger.
Really?
Yeah, it's got to be a
black and, woolly bugger.
I'm probably going to get some argumentation about this, but unless you're fishing woolly buggers under And they do fish what they're calling a micro leeches now, or or micro woolly buggers, whatever, micro buggers. Do not use bead heads.
No.
Stay away from bead heads.
Somebody else told me that
unless you are fishing under an indicator, then you can use a bead head, or you can actually tie them on a jig style hook, and they're deadly. They work great, especially if you have wave action. But a bead head, in my opinion, now you can use a clear bead or a black bead.
But you don't want weight.
You don't want that weight at the end. I have done.
And why is that? Well, why do you not want weight?
The fly's not natural. I think for the most part that, you know, and this is open to conjecture, but woolly buggers imitate a myriad, you know, a plethora of different bugs.
Yeah.
But mostly I think they imitate leeches. Yeah. They imitate dragonflies, damselflies. I'm trying to think of the other thing. Maybe in smaller sizes, shrimp or scuds or stuff like that. You know, they're just a general imitation. But none of those bugs have that up and down undulating motion. None of them do.
No.
None of
them do. That's right. That's what it does. If it's got weight, it's doing that.
None of them do.
So you want to just be in
You want that babel. And in addition to that, I tie my woolly buggers with a one thin strip of wire in them, not wound wire
on which side of the hook?
One thin strip. If you want, if you want the hook to ride with the hook up, you tie them on the back. It helps. But if you want them to ride down, you tie them on the bottom. And you know that's
laying. You're usually not on the bottom with your fly.
But if you're fishing the correct line, you know,
which is what's a good line?
Well, if it's shallow water, you can fish a floating line, a long leader, you know, and a slightly weighted booger. But if you're fishing, say, what we call a slime line, a clear line. The sink rate is very similar. That bug is going to sink, even if you're using a 10-foot, 12-foot, 15-foot leader, with that little bit of weight in that bugger, it's going to sink at about the same rate as your intermediate sinking line is going to sink. And until you get into the, you know, the real, you know, 200-300 grain lines, you know, that that's a whole other thing. So, but mostly you're fishing these clear lines, and what'll happen is the bug will have about the same sink rate.
So you're a few feet under the surface?
With an intermediate line, you can fish, you know, a foot and a half, 2 feet, say all the way up to 8-10 feet, depending on how long you want to wait for it to sink and your retrieve rate. But the key, I think, is that bug will sit there at about the same level as the line will.
So when you strip, it's not doing this. And you can, it's just coming
It comes straight at, it'll come straight at you. And then, and as leeches, particularly, and damsel flies too. If you've ever seen a damsel fly, they'll just wiggle and then they'll stop and they just suspend.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, and that's what it will
they
do.
They wiggle.
Right.
And they stop and they suspend. And a lot of your takes are going to be right at the stop.
Okay, because they're chasing it and then you just stop it right in front of them.
And the same thing with leeches. Leeches will retract they'll swim and shoot out like this, then they'll retract back into a ball, especially if they see danger. But they won't go down and sink.
No.
They'll just float.
Nice.
Effortless. So, you know, those are homespun theories, but they're proven.
Makes sense. And then what would be another fly? So you got the bugger. What would be another go-to lake? And you said ants, right?
Yeah, but, if you're searching, of course, parachute atoms.
Really? Parachute atoms on lakes?
Yeah. Okay. You know, they're going to imitate a lot of different things. Caddises.
Yeah.
You know, I tie my parachute atoms with a different wing. I don't use a white wing very often. Yeah. I do fish them for visibility reasons, but I actually tie them with grizzly hen hackle.
Oh, right. Yeah. And why is that?
I just like that dark silhouette that they give.
As opposed to they're seeing.
And they're difficult to tie because of the material. Oh, yeah. You can use a myriad of different tying things for them. But that's a good searching fly, but they're... there's a lot of good, as far as sunk flies go, I think the next one is a pheasant tail or a hare's ear.
Okay.
They're just searching patterns. Yeah. They always seem to work.
And you fish those, could you trail those off of a woolly bugger?
You could. Yeah. A lot of people fish two, three, even four flies.
Yeah.
Now, you know, the midges, that's become real popular. Marlin calls them Corona bobbers.
Corona bobbers, I know. There's a guy up in Canada who I talked to who's a big... bobber.
Chan?
And then his counterpart. Those guys love the whole hook thing is totally different too.
The jig hooks and all that. Hey, those guys got some really cool stuff going, and they're into it, and they're resourceful tires and fishermen, and they're highly respected members of the fly fishing community.
Phil Roy is the other guy.
Right.
Phil Roy and Chan.
Personally, I don't like to watch a bobber.
No.
You know, if you
like
going, to work.
And that's exactly that's exactly what Ricker said. He's like, if you want to go watch a bobber, but I like to fish. He basically made the point that that's almost not even fishing.
There are a lot of people out there. Then I met a guy this year on Crane Prairie Reservoir, who, by the way, is from New Jersey.
Yeah,
and he's got a very direct personality. Yeah. Let's say, and he actually will give people a bunch of shit. What's the matter? Can't you cast?
Right.
That's not my cup of tea there. I mean, whatever you want to do is fine with me. Yeah, but I do. I agree with Danny on that on that level.
Yeah.
I want to cast and I want to fish.
Yeah.
You know.
That's it.
And don't get me wrong. There's been times in Montana recently I fished midges under a bobber.
Yeah.
And it was fish after fish.
Did you fish more lakes or streams in Montana?
I fished both.
Both.
It was a mad rush, everywhere. I fished... I fished Ennis Lake. That fishing was extraordinary.
No kidding.
Those fish were so hot.
Oh, wow.
And big.
Yeah.
Some of them got very big.
What did you catch? What pattern was it?
I was fishing almost all some facsimile of calabatus hatches.
Oh, yeah. Baby calabatus.
There was some trico hatches early in the morning and some, like, I'm not familiar with it, some pale dun thing.
Oh, yeah.
But they were all, like, 20s to 26s, 28s.
Geez.
Fish were really tough to catch that way. But every day there from about 10 o'clock on, there were calabatus hatches of a dun, spinners or a combination of them. So we were fishing. I was fishing pheasant tails mostly long leaders.
The pheasant tail is a great calabatus imitation.
I have some other imitations that I use. They're kind of bastardizations of pheasant tails. That were working real well. But again, long leaders.
So 15, what's the longest?
I was going, when the water was quiet, I was going 17.
Yeah.
And it made a difference.
Yeah.
That extra 2 feet.
Yeah. What's so you got flies. What about resources? If you think of, are there any like books or anything, anything that you use that would be good for lakes that would help somebody if they didn't know much about lake fishing?
Yeah. Randall Kaufman. Now, again, I'm an old school boy.
Sure. Oh, yeah, old school. Okay. There's tons of good. I mean, Al McLean, I just had somebody the other day asking that question.
Yeah.
Al McLean is a great resource. He said that encyclopedia is unbelievable.
I'm going to speak about this for a minute. In regards to Randall Kaufman's book, Fishing Lakes. Best book I've ever read.
No kidding.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it's extraordinary,
in
my opinion. Yeah. Now, there's probably other books out there that, are right there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one I read, and I highly respect Randall in that book. There's another book in regards to fishing in general, and this is really old school, but it's Ray Bergman's Trout.
Trout, exactly. Yep.
And that book will teach you a lot of things that all these videos and YouTubers will have not even thought about. Regards to sunshine, shadow, approach, how to catch the fish nearest you, play the fish nearest you. There's an amazing amount of information. Some of it's just, you know, past its time. So
It's but Bergman's, I mean, he's a huge. That's a huge resource.
It's a Bible. When I was in, back to when I was a kid, I read that book five times.
There you go.
Cover to cover.
Rings about. Yeah. So now, when you think, so you fished tons of places. I mean, is there any place out there that you haven't been to that you'd love to still go to and fish?
Yeah, I like to go to BC. In terms of freshwater, I'd like to go to BC. Your dad always talked about BC lakes.
Oh, right, just the Kamloops and stuff.
Yeah, I'd like to go fish the lakes in BC, and I have yet to land a big tarpon. I've jumped seven tarpon.
So you've been tarpon fishing?
I have, yeah. Okay. And my biggest one, according to a guide there, John Oakes was his name, he said somewhere between 170 and 190.
So you're not talking baby tarpon, you're talking big.
No,
these were big boys. Where was this at?
It was in Punta Gorda, Florida. Yeah.
Oh, Florida, yeah.
Yeah, okay, Florida, right. Yeah.
Yeah, we had
I'd like to go back to Florida. Yeah. Unfortunately, fishing's not what it used to be there in that area for various reasons.
Gotcha. But yeah, Bruce Chard is a big giant tarpon guy.
I've heard about it. I don't know a lot, but I've heard all the hotshot guides, you know, Greg Moon down in Louisiana and John Oakes and several other Florida guides talk about the Seychelles.
Oh, yeah. Seychelles.
Expensive trip, a long
flight.
Bucket
list. It's on my bucket list.
I would love to go to the Seychelles.
I'm planning on getting there for sure. Yeah. I know. There's like I said, I've interviewed so many people now. These stories have come up, but there's one guy who just keeps on Instagram. He keeps posting these crazy. He's fished everywhere, and it's pretty unbelievable.
It's supposed to be something else.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Anything? Anything we left out? I mean, we could probably, the funny thing is on the river. We've sat here and talked and told stories many times, and I just wanted to get together like this just to, like I said, get something on the books because, you've been a big influence for me over the years and I wanted to let people that, follow me kind of hear from a person, who was a big influence for me. So, this has been fun. And I guess, next thing we just need to get a trip together. It's been a little while since we've been fishing.
It's been too long.
Yeah.
It has been, so I understand you're busy with your family and those things, but.
No, we should try to maybe, the next, next year or whatever, and find something we can get out. And,
well, hopefully, God willing and everything, I'm going to be out there. I'm going back to Montana next year.
Yep.
We were there for almost a month, and I didn't want to come home.
No, I know. Montana's great.
We blew up just one little added thing, and this is something that most people don't know about. But on the suggestion of a really young hotshot guide in Ennis, and I don't remember his name, I found out that you can catch giant rainbows and browns in the middle of lakes and on grasshopper patterns.
No kidding, in the middle of lakes.
Mm-hmm.
That's weird.
And that's a new thing for me. I've always caught them along shorelines, but I had
They're just something just floating, gets blown.
I had fish blowing up on big grasshoppers in the middle of Georgetown Lake near Phillipsburg, Montana. Wow. Fish up to 28 inches. And again, it was like sharks eating penguins. They were leaving spray trails of like 3 feet.
Really?
Yeah, it was awesome. So when you go out there, guys, don't forget about the grasshoppers at that right.
And who's it? This is Mac, right?
This is Mac. He's yellow bird dog.
So you got Mac. Before Mac was who?
Deschutes.
Deschutes. And before Deschutes.
His name is actually McKenzie.
Mr. Little.
Yeah.
So now you got Mac.
And Mac's a good dog. And we just had our dog, who was 15, Canoe, we had to put down recently. Yeah, it was tough. It was tough. We had the vet came over to our house, had the kids there. We were all there with the dog. It was really tough. But it's an interesting thing with animals because not like a week later, this cat shows up out of nowhere. And it turns out it looks just like our dog.
Oh, that's spooky.
Yeah. I know. I was like, well, okay. So now we have a cat.
Ooh.
I know.
Yeah.
So we got a cat. But all right, Gene. Well, hey, just wanted to thank you for
it's been great, Dave. It's been wonderful. It's been too long. Yeah, we've got a lot of other stories to share.
Well, maybe we'll do this as a
some of them not suitable for public
exactly
listening or viewing.
That's right. This is a family show. I I definitely keep it clean. So mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe we'll get on, maybe do this again in a year or two and check in with
I
you.
Hope
see,
so.
See
I hope so.
I hope
so. God willing, yeah, we'll be out there. Right. Maybe you can make it to Montana with me next year.
Yeah, or bird hunting. I do have plans for bird hunting because I still have my shotgun, mm-hmm. even though I think I gave away my decoys when I.
I thought you were going to say you gave away your plug.
No, exactly. No, I still have my shotgun, and I do need to find a gun for my kid. Mm-hmm. See if I can get her something, a starter gun, which is probably like what would it be?
Get a 20-gauge auto.
Yeah, 20-gauge auto.
Yeah.
Yeah, something mm-hmm. like that. And then for gas a rifle, operated, probably yeah. not 243, which is a little bit older. What do you get a kid that's only in the 9 range?
Mm, yeah, 2506 or something. Yeah, I don't know.
Even a 22.
Yeah,
right, or something.
22. Even, yeah. Yeah. Something so. Small. I mean, you're not going to shoot much with it, but
no.
It'd be fun to go out and plink yeah. around with. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, I'll wrap this up and we'll press stop here.
Been a pleasure.
All right.
So there you go. If you want to find all the show notes, all the links we covered, just go to wetflyswing.com/163. Head over to wetflyswing.com/trips and find out where we are heading next this year. I want to thank you again for stopping by today to check out the show. I'm looking forward to catching up soon. I hope to maybe see you on the river or online.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com. And if you found this episode helpful, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes.